From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Donald Trump's finances have been in the spotlight. New York's attorney general is now investigating the Trump Charitable Foundation's 2013 gift to the Florida attorney general, which Trump was fined for. And the Washington Post and the AP are reporting that Trump doesn't put money in his charitable foundation. He uses other people's money. Well, today, Newsweek takes a look at his business, the Trump Organization. And senior writer Kurt Eichenwald argues that while there's no evidence of anything illegal, almost every foreign policy decision that Trump would make if elected would raise serious national security conflicts. Kurt joins us now. And Kurt, you write that Donald Trump doesn't really build anything anymore. He sells his name for millions through his Trump Organization. Developers put it on buildings in places like South Korea. Now, earlier this year, Trump made a threat that South Korea should pay for its military without U.S. help. You say that would benefit his South Korean business partner.
Exactly. I mean, you have a situation in South Korea, you know, particularly where Trump is talking about, well, they might have to get their own nukes, where his partner is the primary developer of nuclear energy programs. You've got a circumstance where everything that comes out of his mouth in terms of policy, you can pretty much find a country where he has a financial conflict of interest.
Another item that caught our eye, in Turkey, the country where a major U.S. military base is situated, Trump lent his name, again, this is what he does, sells his name for millions of dollars to a tower complex in Istanbul with the Dogan construction family. The president, Erdogan, was there at the ribbon cutting, but the Dogan construction family fell out of favor. They've had all sorts of criminal charges against them. The Turkish president is now lashing out at Trump.
Right. You know, now you have the president angry for having had any involvement with Trump in the past, saying it was a mistake. And, you know, as my story reports, I've been told that the president of Turkey is severely questioning whether if there is a Trump administration, given their dealings in the past, whether they would allow the United States to continue utilizing the air base there that is a critical element of are bombing on ISIS.
Well, what about in Russia, though? Because you tell us that Trump is friendly with a controversial Russian figure, Vladimir Potanin, who is the host of the Russian version of The Apprentice. It's called The Candidate. Very interesting. Trump, through the Trump Organization, is the show's executive producer. And we also know that Donald Trump's been criticized for his comments about President Putin. But what is wrong with his having those relations with Russia? Some might say he might have inroads into Russia. What's wrong outside of the potentially unnerving sight, as you write, of having a U.S. president's name emblazoned on buildings in Moscow?
You have a situation where Russian oligarchs could legally bribe the Trump family just by striking deals with them. And, you know, when you have a scenario where the financial interests of Donald Trump lie with the government of Russia, then you have a very serious issue of, is he going to be hard on Russia or is he going to think about, I'm getting millions of dollars out of there, you know, first? And you got to think back to, you remember when Brexit happened? He said, Brexit's great for me. You know, there's going to be more business for my golf course. Well, that's the way the guy thinks.
Kurt Eichenwald, what's the difference between the Trump Organization and the Clinton Family Foundation? We know the emails that showed foundation donors tried to get some influence with then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Some did get a meeting with her. What's the difference in your mind?
Well, it's huge. The money going to the Clinton Foundation, you know, goes to things like buying AIDS drugs in Africa.
90% of the Clinton Foundation money, it's been documented, go to charitable causes.
Right, exactly. And none of the money goes to the Clintons. The people who they say, well, they gave money and had a meeting with the Secretary of State. They would have had a meeting with any Secretary of State.
Well, and you've already said that there's nothing illegal about what Trump is doing. This is his business. There's just potential conflict of interest. He says that he's going to put it in a blind trust or give it over to his children. Doesn't that somewhat take care of it?
No, it's ridiculous. It's like saying I have 100 million shares of Apple stock and I'm going to put it in a blind trust. You know exactly what's in there. If his children are there, the money is still going to the Trump family. And so, you know, there is no way out of this other than Trump and his family permanently cutting off their relationship with the Trump Organization. You know, he can either be president or he can have the Trump Organization. He cannot have both. American national security cannot be up for sale to the highest bidder.
Kurt Eichenwald, senior writer for Newsweek, contributing editor for Vanity Fair. I'm sure we're going to have a lot more response to your reporting as the day goes on. Kurt, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we continue to follow the presidential race, we're also checking in on Senate races around the country in our weekly Senate Tracker series. This week, the race for an open seat in Indiana, where incumbent Republican Dan Coats has decided not to seek re-election. The Republican running is Congressman Todd Young. The Democrat is former Senator Evan Bayh. And Brandon Smith is Statehouse reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. He joins us from Indianapolis. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk about Evan Bayh first, because this is somebody people may remember. He was in the Senate for a while and left in 2010. Why did he leave and why did he decide to get into the race this time?
Well, those are two very interesting questions. The reason he said he left the Senate in 2010 is that he was fed up with the partisanship and the divisiveness that existed in Congress at the time. And it was a surprise to those when he returned, because it's not like the partisanship and divisiveness seems to have dissipated much in those few years. He says he came back because he looked at his children and just couldn't stand the partisanship and feels like he can bridge the gap in Congress, returning to the U.S. Senate. Now, there are some who believe he left the Senate race in 2010 because he was facing a particularly tough re-election bid and was sort of scared off by his Republican opponent. And as he came back to the race here in 2016, he was sort of encouraged to do so by national Democrats.
Well, let's listen to an ad from him.
Republican Senator Dick Lugar and Evan Bayh worked together to save our auto jobs, but Todd Young joined the Tea Party attacking the plan. He called saving 100,000 Hoosier jobs a waste.
What a waste. All the more reason to let it go belly up.
Young chose the Tea Party over Indiana jobs.
What are the issues Evan Bayh is running on, and how closely is he tying himself to Hillary Clinton?
He sort of stayed away from Hillary Clinton a little bit. He's obviously been tied to the Clintons for a very long time, including being rumored to be on the shortlist for her running mate back in 2008. And those ties have remained close, though he hasn't emphasized them as much this time because Hillary Clinton is not exactly popular in Indiana. Donald Trump is leading here by a fairly considerable margin. The issues he's running on are really he labels himself as a fiscal conservative. He speaks to those sorts of, you know, bridging the gap between Republicans and Democrats, willing to find bipartisanship where it exists, work with the other party to find common sense solutions for the federal government, for the country, for Indiana. That's sort of the brand he's built for himself over a series of really decades here in Indiana, and that's what he's running on again.
And I understand he's facing some questions about his residency.
He is. So back in 2010 when he left the Senate, he listed his primary residence for a number of years as a home he had in the Washington, D.C. area in Georgetown. Though he, as he's come back to run for the Senate, he claims, oh, I've never left Indiana. And he does have a condo here and kept that condo throughout the last several years. While there are really no legal issues involved here, the legal issues are very clear. You just have to be a resident of the state at the time of election. It's clear that he fulfills that requirement. But there are perception issues at play, and the Republicans have really attacked him on that.
Well, let's get to the Republican who is running against him. This is an ad from Todd Young.
Evan Bayh, Washington changed him, made millions as a super lobbyist. One news report even called Bayh the living embodiment of everything corrupt and dispiriting about American politics. Todd Young, a Marine, a Naval Academy graduate, and the only one with a backbone to stand up to the Clinton-Obama agenda.
Tell us about Todd Young, and is he endorsing Donald Trump?
Todd Young, as he mentions in his ad there, and as he mentions almost every time you speak to him or hear him speak, Todd Young is a Marine. He served in the Marines. He's been a congressman here in Indiana for about 6 years now, a former attorney. He is not formally endorsed Donald Trump, but neither has he disavowed him in any way. He's supporting the Republican nominee for president and really trying to dodge questions about Donald Trump whenever he can. He's a fairly young guy, thought to be a rising star in the Hoosier political scene, and was facing a pretty easy road to election in this Senate race before Evan Bayh joined it.
And Todd Young did not support the auto bailout, which I guess is a pretty big deal there in Indiana.
it's a real big deal here in Indiana. It's one of the most intensive auto manufacturing states in the country. And while Todd Young wasn't in Congress for the auto bailout when he was running in 2010, his opponent had voted for it, and he attacked him over and over on that vote as well as others, including Obamacare, which is one of the central issues that Todd Young has been attacking Evan Bayh on in this race.
So what do the polls say?
The polls have been narrowing. Evan Bayh jumped out to a really big lead, which was built a lot on his name recognition, which he has a ton of and Todd Young didn't have nearly as much of. But over the last few weeks, it has been narrowing more and more to where right now I would argue it's almost too close to call.
Brandon Smith, Statehouse reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, talking with us about the Senate race in Indiana. Brandon, we'll be watching. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And if you want to check out some of the Senate races in other states, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Senate races in Missouri, North Carolina, Alaska, Georgia, and on and on. That's at hereandnow.org. When you ask your boss a question, is the answer often no? For many employees, it is, as managers try to keep priorities straight and to make sure projects stay on schedule and on budget. But saying no too often can stifle good ideas and hurt the bottom line. Joining us from Salt Lake City is David Sturt, who's executive vice president at O.C. Tanner and the author of Great Work, How to Make a Difference People Love. David, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And why do you think so many managers feel the need to start off with no?
You know, I think part of it is because they have usually spent quite a bit of time trying to get their processes working. You know, they're on the hook for delivering results and delivering a certain level of quality. And so when employees come to them with new ideas or things that they want to try, that's part of the natural thing that happens to managers is to protect the current processes, to protect the way things have been done, to ensure some level of quality or making good on the commitments that they've made.
And when you look at that, do you say, well, they're doing the right thing by saying no, or is that the wrong way to approach things?
You know, I think it's a balance. If you focus primarily on saying no and shutting down those new ideas, there's some real downsides to that. One, after a while, your team members are not going to keep coming with new ideas, and they will start believing that you as a leader really aren't into progress, aren't into innovation, and it squelches not only their ability to think innovatively, but even their engagement. If they feel like, hey, I'm just here to do the work that's been required of me, and they sort of turn their brain off, they turn their creative energy off, and I think that ends up hurting teams. I think you have to be very, very careful about what you say no to.
Do you see a difference between the way that managers behave at large organizations that have been around for a long time versus startups where things tend to need to move more quickly?
Definitely. And it's a problem that happens fairly frequently because if you think about it in those early days as a startup, you're saying yes to all kinds of things. You're trying to fill in a vision of doing something that hasn't been done before. And so you're dealing with a lot of uncertainty. You're taking risk. It's just sort of baked in to the process of young, early startup companies. And then what happens, and it's an unintended consequence, you get this almost calcification, this rigidity that starts setting in as they formulate and plan out their work processes and streamline their operations. And then it shuts out some of that innovative, fresh thinking. And it can be damaging. And I had a funny example of this that I was actually really impressed by. I was at a company called Qualcomm. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They have about 30,000 employees worldwide, just this global mobile tech powerhouse. And I was chatting with their head of engineering about how they do that. And he talked about a specific meeting where the CEO and the senior executive team called a global leadership meeting, 400 of their VPs from around the world, and they said, we need to say yes more often. We've become so big and so successful that I think we're saying no too often because in the early days when we just began as a company, we could say yes to things that no one else could say yes to. We could find a way to innovate and to solve really difficult problems. And they were trying to re-inject that early DNA that really caused their success and bring it back into now a much bigger organization to really say yes. And they actually gave everybody this cool button, a great big blue button that said yes on it. And if you hit it, it had the CEO and other executives going, yes, yes, absolutely.
And did that work? Was that effective for them?
You know, I think it has been effective. I've heard that it's really kind of establishing itself in the culture of the company. It shows up in conference rooms and meetings, and they have fun with it. And I think it just helps remind them that that's the source of their creative energy and their long-term success as an organization.
So do you expect other companies to do the same thing now?
I think so. I think, you know, years ago, the dominant management philosophy and the thing that everybody was talking about and moving toward was more of what I would call a culture of compliance. It was trying to limit the variation in the work processes and try to streamline and drive efficiency gains and do those kinds of things that tend to, if you're not careful, prohibit some experimentation and some new thinking and some trying of new ways of doing things. And I see now all over the world. I was just in India recently and seeing them pursuing hard this issue of how do we create new value, which means you've got to approach your work with a slightly different mindset and think about saying yes a lot more than you've said no in the past.
That's David Sturt, Executive Vice President at O.C. Tanner and author of Great Work, How to Make a Difference People Love. David, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Great being with you.
Well, a couple hours north of Kansas City, Missouri, amid rolling fields and roads, perfect for running, by the way, you'll find Clarinda, Iowa. As small towns go, Clarinda's doing pretty well. It has a regional health center, a couple of small colleges, a few farm equipment dealerships. And as C.J. Janavi from Here and Now contributor KCUR discovered, it's become a contemporary art destination.
Robert and Karen Duncan moved to Lincoln, Nebraska back in the 1960s. Robert came to run the family business, Duncan Aviation, a worldwide airplane service company. They also started collecting art.
We've got a beautiful collection that we've put together beginning in the 70s, so 40 years.
The Duncan's home is designed to be a museum. Outside, 40 acres of pristine landscaping for a sculpture garden. They have other collections, too, including Karen's books, more than 10,000 of them. One day she got an earful from her property manager.
She said to me, "We have to do something about the books. There's no place to put them. We need to build a building out north of the house, and we could store art in it, and we could put all the books. It could be our library." And finally I said, "Susan, I don't want to build a building. If we do anything, I would buy a Carnegie library and move it on the property, and that would be our library."
Andrew Carnegie financed libraries all around the country in the early 1900s. A lot of them have been repurposed, so they got online to see what was for sale.
There on the screen is the library that I spent my entire childhood and all my young years in.
That library sits 100 miles east of Lincoln in Clarinda, Iowa, where Robert and Karen both grew up.
Clarinda Carnegie Library to be auctioned off Tuesday. As the next day,
the Duncans bought it. Moving it turned out to be impossible, though, so they made other plans.
We loan our collection, we move it around, and so why not create a museum in Clarinda? Because people in that community, and indeed in small communities all across the country, do not get exposure to fine art.
The Duncans fixed up the old library, and the Clarinda Carnegie Art Museum opened in 2014.
This is really high-class stuff.
Clarinda Mayor Gordon Kokenge.
And so the touring industry gets involved. So now we have these tour buses coming in.
Clarinda has other attractions, bandleader Glenn Miller's birthplace, and, as the mayor boasts, 14 restaurants. But the Duncan's collection of art, big enough to change exhibitions every 6 months, is something new. It even provoked some calls to City Hall.
They had this old car out there sitting out on the sidewalk, and it had burned up, or they burned it up, and it was some form of art. Well, it just so happened that
the police department had plans to ticket old jalopies and haul them away.
So then we had people saying, well, you're coming to pick ours up, but you left this one set down there at the museum.
It's by an artist from Argentina who calls himself Race.
He had restored all and then destroyed it because the world wasn't right and he wanted to take a stand.
That's Chase McAndrews. He's 13 years old. 10 kids volunteer as docents at the museum, studying up so they can explain the art to anyone who comes through. Like in the current exhibition of international art, there's a sculpture of prayer beads by a Saudi Arabian artist.
She had women come in and write their names on them before they were married to their husbands, because once you're married to your husband, you're property. So this was how they were going to get recognized in the world, by having their name on a piece of art. I think it's amazing.
Trish Okamoto, the museum's director, lures other kids with fun programs or just a bowl of M&Ms near the front door. Other folks don't need that much bait.
At meetings uptown, like lunch meetings and things like that, and overhearing conversation. Not that you intentionally do that, but you'll hear conversations and people say, have you been to our museum? Have you been to our art museum?
It took a while, like after the installation of Brad Howe's giant aluminum circles on the front lawn.
A local farmer, and this is a guy I've known my whole life, and he still calls me Sugar Britches. He says, Sugar Britches, your guys left a whole bunch of air conditioned ducking out in front. And I said, no, that's a piece of art. You're kidding me.
She told him to come back and look again.
I get the phone call the next day. You're right, that's not air conditioning ducking. I said, I know it's not. What'd you think? I don't get it. I said, you know what? You got in your car and you went to check it out. And he's so fun, he's been here for every single show.
So have a lot of other people. The Duncans say 12,000 people have been through the museum in the couple of years it's been open. That's more than twice as many people as live in the whole town. For Here and Now, I'm CJ Janovy, reporting from Clarinda, Iowa.
Do you have a Fitbit to monitor your physical activity? Well, how would you feel about a Fitbit for your job-related activity? That's how the company Humanize described it when we spoke about a year ago. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. It is a new employee ID badge. It's equipped with microphones and sensors to tell how much time you spend at your desk, whether you talk during meetings, everything but bathroom breaks, and then all that information is sent to your boss. So how is this all going a year on? Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. And Maggie, remind listeners what this badge will and won't do. For instance, it doesn't record the content of what you say, just the tone and when you talk.
Right, which is, I'm sure, causing a sigh of relief for everyone thinking my boss can hear everything I say about them. But yes, it's sort of like your ID pass on steroids. It has sensors that record where you go, but only within the building, motion detectors that sense how much you're actually moving, your physical activity, and tiny microphones that record how much you're speaking and who you are speaking to, not exactly what you were saying. And it provides all of this in real-time analysis. So it's wearable technology for the corporate world. But Robin, I think everyone's first reaction is it raises a lot of questions about surveillance, and it can sound a little creepy.
Right. Well, we spoke, as we said, with the company a year ago. Mm-hmm. People, our listeners, were just livid. Well, you know what? We can't have that. You spoke this morning with Humanize CEO Ben Wabber, and he's now calling for more regulation to make sure the device is used properly. Let's listen to a little.
If you use it to spy on people, any benefit you get would be dwarfed by the negative reaction that people will legitimately have. And so we do need government to step up and start leading the charge on that as well.
So just a little bit more, Maggie. What's he talking about there?
Yeah, listen, they completely acknowledge, as by the way, do many tech CEOs that I talked to that said, listen, we're making all these advances with technology, but the regulation is woefully behind where we are. There needs to be protection in place for consumers, for people, when it comes to privacy, when it comes to surveillance, because all of this can be misused. But they don't want to get lost in the conversation, the fact that they do believe that it has benefits. That's why they created it. Mm-hmm. And they really believe that these devices can help companies make better decisions about how to improve your workplace. And he gave us a great example about how companies view coworkers eating lunch together. They said, listen, they think of it as a distraction and a cost until we got data back that showed that it was one of the key elements that was actually increasing performance. And that made the company think very differently about, did they want to provide lunch for their coworkers and encourage people to get up off your desk and eat together? So these are the kind of things that this technology can do. It's the positive case story behind it. You just have to make sure you have the protections in place.
Right. I mean, a lot of companies want to know how come one division's doing better than another, and they might find people.
And they don't know. Yeah. And they don't know why.
Right. And what about employees? Is there anything they can use from this data?
Yeah, well, I said, you know, this – okay, I get why companies want this, but what about the individual? Are you going to be penalized because you're somebody who worries and your blood pressure goes up in stressful times and they sense that, or that you're somebody who's shy and isn't that talkative? And he acknowledged that, listen, this is meant to improve. And I think a lot of people think they're doing something, but maybe the reality is different. And I'm going to compare it to that silly feature that people dismissed on the Apple Watch, which tells you to stand up. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out people sit more than they thought. And so if you think you're very social, but then the data tells you you actually spent 2 hours responding to emails and not talking, that may change your perception. Or you skip lunch because you think that shows you're a hard worker. Mm. But when in reality, that lunch period is an important networking time. So I think individuals can find a way to use this, again, if the protections are in place.
Maggie Lake of CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thank you.
There have been some alarming developments over the past week or so in North Korea. Last week, the country performed another nuclear test. This week, two U.S. military B-1 bombers flew over South Korea in a show of force against North Korea. General Vincent Brooks is commander of U.S. forces in South Korea.
North Korea's nuclear test represents a dangerous escalation and poses an unacceptable threat.
And now, a Japanese lawmaker who just returned from the North Korean capital, Pyongyang, says North Korea's nuclear program is directed at the United States. The country has claimed after past tests it does have the capability to strike the U.S. with nuclear weapons. That's a claim that experts say is not true. The leader of North Korea, 32-year-old Kim Jong-un, is an enigma. So to learn more about him, we're joined via Skype by Andrew Nathan, professor of political science at Columbia University. He specializes in Asian policy. And Professor Nathan, as you looked into Kim Jong-un, what are the three most important things we should know about him?
Three things. Well, he's come in as the third generation of a kind of crazy to us dictatorship, and he's inherited that system. He probably believes in the system, even though he was schooled overseas. And yet, even if he didn't believe in it, there's really no way out of it. You know, he can't reform, I think, probably, never say never, but I doubt he has any way of reforming the system without having the system collapse, because the rest of the world around him is in a kind of, you know, modern type of political systems, whether it's China or South Korea. Another thing to know is that he's very young, and Korean society tends to respect old people. So this is a strike against him. He has to be really strong in order to tame everybody around him. And I suppose a third thing to think about is that North Korea is a society of scarcity, and the regime survives through a very strict system of stratification where the military and the political leadership, but especially the military, which is really the pillar of his power, is privileged. And other people are doing very badly. And for a period of time, there was literally a famine, but now most of the population is just extremely poor. And so the system survives partly by the fear of those who have enough to eat and have warm apartments being purged, and the others cannot rebel because there is a privileged group on top keeping control.
Well, I want to go to what you just said about him being young. You write that he actually gained weight in order to look like his father and his grandfather, and that he's got the same hairstyle as his father.
Yeah. So there are these three generations of the Kim family, and they are presented in North Korean propaganda as something godlike. And there's a mystique that is handed down from father to son to grandson. And so to make that work, the propaganda people have groomed him to look like his father, and even more so to look like his grandfather. His father actually was quite skinny. But it doesn't make sense to you and me and to your listeners, I think. Why does that make any difference? It's a bit akin to some kind of religious sect, I suppose. where there's some magical quality. And if you read the North Korean propaganda, this is what they claim: our great leader who's descended from our previous great leaders and has this magic quality of leadership is going to make us all winners.
Do you get the sense that he himself believes that, or that he's just propagandizing?
We don't have, you know, access really. And everything that we know on the outside is part of the public show. There are rumors about not only him, but his father, not so much about the grandfather, in private, watching Western movies, drinking expensive brandy, you know, having European prostitutes and living a high life. And it's a little bit like that movie, I forget the name of the movie with Seth Rogen, that there's a secret private life, but we don't know that. It's all in the form of rumors. It's hard to believe that he literally believes in the whole system. But as I said, he's kind of stuck in this system. If he were to come out and say, this has all been a joke, the famine was a joke, and so forth, I don't think that would allow his regime to survive, because it's not an isolated regime. Right across the border, you have a highly prosperous and westernized South Korea, and across the other border, a very prosperous and not democratic, but prosperous and rather cosmopolitan China. So as soon as you begin to open up to the rest of the world, I think the North Korean population will be sort of scratching their heads and saying, what was all that about, you know, for the last how many decades has it been?
And by the way, the movie that you were talking about is called The Interview,
yes, thank you.
Which made a lot of news in this country when it came out as well.
It was an imaginative movie that might have struck close to the truth or not. We really don't have the scientific evidence, social science evidence to prove it.
We're speaking with Andrew Nathan, who's a professor of political science at Columbia University, about North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. You're listening to Here and Now. And Andrew Nathan, what do we know about Kim Jong-un's control over the military? We know that he purged dozens of high-ranking military officers, as well as some senior party and security officials, after he took power. But how much control does he have over the military?
He seems to have a tremendous amount of control, and it's hard to imagine how that works. But I think the answer is he has purged, and violently purged, and, you know, killed and sent to labor camps families of senior generals for things, at least what they said in the public announcements, were that this general showed disrespect. He dozed off during a speech by the leader, things like this. There's probably more behind it. But he's been incredibly ruthless in purging people. And the one that was the most shocking, of course, was his uncle, not a military official, but at that time, the number two most powerful official in the whole system. And he purged his uncle, which is really rare, even in dictatorships, for the dictator to execute, not just purge, but kill a close relative, his aunt's husband. And so I think fear is a big part of the answer. Secondly, there must be, and again, we don't know how this works, but there must be an extensive spy system within the military and people reporting on one another in order to show their loyalty. So people are very much afraid. Third, he puts all the resources of the regime into the military. As I said, they have a privileged lifestyle, but in addition to that, they're ballyhooed in the propaganda, and the military has control of these wonderful nuclear weapons and missile development programs, so that the military is, I think, by and large, pretty happy with their role in the regime.
Do you think that he would ever, based on what you know about him, actually use a nuclear weapon?
The rational calculus is that he's using these weapon systems to deter what he thinks is an aim by the U.S. and South Korea to cause his regime to collapse, especially the U.S., less so South Korea, that the U.S. wants to use either military force or political subversion and propaganda to make the regime collapse, which would lead to the end of him, in the same way as, for example, Gaddafi. And so he's using this as a deterrent that is not intended to be used. Now, if he thought the attack was actually imminent on him, or the collapse of the regime was actually imminent, if, for example, we ramped up sanctions as is being discussed by the administration and got the Chinese to cooperate, which they probably wouldn't. But if we did, and he was looking down the gun barrel of more famine and an economic collapse, and the regime has not collapsed so far economically. They have a mild rate of economic growth. If he was looking at real collapse, would his rationality be the same as my rationality? I don't know. And I hesitate to put, you know, all of my retirement savings on that speculation. I might put it, part of it down, but not all of it.
That's Andrew Nathan, professor of political science at Columbia University, talking with us about Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. Professor, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
In case you haven't been paying attention to the Paralympics, and by the way, we all should be paying attention, did you see that Iranian Paralympic volleyball player taller than the net? Anyway, the Paralympics wraps up Sunday in Rio, and here's another wow. In last Sunday's 1500-meter final, all four runners, yes, all four of the top finishers, beat the time of the gold medal-winning able-bodied runner Matt Centrowitz less than a month ago in the Olympic 1500-meter final. Now, if you're thinking, oh, it must be they're wearing blades or have some technology, no. This race was for visually impaired athletes who run unassisted. Runner's World editor Aaron Strout joins us. And Aaron, this is pretty incredible. But first, without guides, how do they run?
Well, the T13 category, which is what these men were running in, they are visually impaired, but they're the least visually impaired of all the classes of athletes that are competing at the Paralympics. So the average person has a 120-degree visual radius, and I think these athletes have about 20 degrees.
It's still phenomenal. I mean, so I'm presuming they can see right in front of them and they can stay in their lanes. But these times, Abdellatif Bacca of Algeria was the gold medal winner. He ran 3:48.29, followed by runners from Ethiopia and Kenya, all of them posting times under Matt Centrowitz's 3:50. 3:48 to 3:50. Now, we rush to note, the 1500 is a race of speed and strategy, and Centrowitz at the Olympics a month ago was said to have a strategy of slowing down the pack.
That's correct. Matthew's strategy was to get on the starting line and test out the field. So he slowed things down from the get-go to see if anybody else was going to make a move, and nobody did. And so, yes, it ended up being a very slow race. And in fact, it was the slowest Olympic 1500 since 1932.
But still, the fact that these Paralympians all beat the time, all four of them. You know, the top three medaled, but the fourth gets to know that he beat an able-bodied Olympian. What's the sense of that in the running world?
I think it's extraordinary. I think people really applaud that. The Paralympic race was great. It kind of played out the same way in that the pack stayed together until the final 400 meters. And so the 3:48.29 winning time was actually a world record for that event in the Paralympics, which is great. And those first four finishers, that was also a best time for their careers as well.
Well, and we know that the fourth place finisher was Abdellatif, the gold winner's brother, Fouad Bacca. Are these athletes, these Paralympians, are they well known in their home countries? And what happens? And you know, it's an incredibly heartwarming moment. But does anything happen for them? Do they get sponsors? Do they, you know, what happens because they're doing so well there?
Absolutely. I think it's very parallel to what happens to our Olympic athletes when they come home with medals. They certainly are up for more sponsorship money, more recognition in general. And I think that happens just as much for Paralympic athletes as it does for the Olympic athletes that we saw medaling last month.
Well, it tells us a lot, too, about the Paralympics, that extraordinary things are happening there. Tell us about some of the other things you've seen.
Yes. Yeah, so I don't know if you've followed the Mikey Brannigan story, but Mikey is an American athlete. He's 19 years old. He's from New York and he's autistic. And yesterday he won a gold medal in his class of the 1500. A really great moment for him. He led from the start. He beat the next fastest finisher by 4 seconds, which in the 1500 meters is a lot of time.
So you applaud that. What else would you recommend?
I always love to follow Tatiana McFadden. She's a very popular Paralympic athlete here in the United States. She can do everything from 100 meters to the marathon. She's really popular on the marathon circuit. She's won all the world marathon majors in her career, and she's just a really great personality to follow as well.
These are Paralympics, so I'm wondering, what has she overcome to get there? What's her disability?
She is a wheelchair athlete. She has spina bifida. She was actually adopted at the age of 6 from Russia. So she has a really great story behind her. In her youth, she tried basketball. She's just a great athlete all around.
Well, it's all a reminder, Erin, that the Olympics are still going on and still worth watching.
Absolutely. And these athletes put in just as much time and preparation as the Olympic athletes that we watched last month, and just as rigorous. And the competition that's going on there is extraordinary, and it's worth watching.
Erin Stout of Runner's World magazine. Erin, thank you.
Thank you.
And we should add, the American wheelchair athlete Tatiana McFadden, Erin spoke about, won the first round of the 5,000-meter race today in Rio. She's already taken gold medals in the 400 and 1,500-meter races. Her goal this year? 7 gold. And speaking of medals, the Paralympics introduced new ones this year so that blind athletes can identify what theirs are by shaking them. The gold, silver, and bronze are filled with tiny steel balls, and each makes a different sound when shaken. So fun to watch and listen to. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.